Hello, everybody, and welcome to the China Tech Investor Podcast, powered by TechNode, seeking truth from facts when it comes to Chinese tech stocks and IPOs. I'm Elliot Zagman, and with me is a man with such deep and wide knowledge of the Chinese macroeconomic and financial situation that he does not laugh like a 13-year-old boy when someone talks about the MLF. It's James Hall.
What's the ML? Okay.
The medium-term lending facility.
Oh, okay. All right.
Every time it comes out, somebody makes a... somebody on Twitter makes a MILF joke.
Yes. Yes. So that is a, a little prequel to our talk today with Andrew Polk from Trivium. But yeah, we do talk about markets. We do talk about investing and hedging and stuff like that. So yeah, none of this is investment advice. You know, speak to your own financial advisor, you know, carefully consider the risks, do your own homework, all these things. You know, yeah, not investment advice.
Yeah. All right. Speaking of MILFs, you know that term was used in American Pie the first time, right? That's where it comes from.
Yes, I remember that movie.
Yeah. I'm in my hometown right now of Grand Rapids, Michigan, which is actually what the movie American Pie was based on.
Oh. Right?
So they go to East Great Falls High School. It means Grand Rapids.
So that's where MILF was invented.
I don't know if that was invented. That was where it was popularized, right? Because they saw Stifler's mom at the party,
right?
And Stifler's mom was the original MILF. So we're going to talk with Andrew Polk. But before that, a few things in the news. One is she and Trump have met at the G20 summit, and apparently they have called a truce to the trade war, I believe. I mean, as much as we can, you know, can really be sure of anything here.
Yeah, I think Trump said we're back on track, which I guess he means we're back to where we were before May, you know, when everything was kind of called off. Mm. So it seems like whatever happened in May is now being either put on hold or taken off the burners completely. Maybe not even on the back burner, maybe. I don't know. But yeah, we'll see. This is a flu. I mean, I don't know. China, U.S., it's a fluid situation.
You never know what's actually going on. Yeah. But it does seem as though they are going to be, the U.S. will be kind of taking the foot off Huawei's throat with a lot of this stuff. I don't know. It hasn't, at least as far as I'm concerned right now, which is 6/29, so June 29th, it seems as though that they have mentioned that they will allow more U.S. companies to do business with Huawei. So it doesn't seem like, I think, for example, that Android thing, maybe we can expect Huawei to continue to be able to use Android. I don't know. Because they haven't really been clear about who exactly will be allowed to do business with Huawei versus who will not. They said that they will, I believe that the term was whether they, unless they pose a direct national security threat, they will be allowed to do business with Huawei.
So, before the meeting this week, you know, we're recording this on the 29th, and actually we recorded the conversation with Andrew earlier on Thursday.
Mm.
So yeah, what
27th.
The 27th? So that's going to be a little different. But before all this happened, there was some news that came out about some of these companies, Micron and Intel, and maybe others, had found a legal loophole where they could still sell to Huawei. And I kind of wonder how much money they spent on the lawyers to give them that green light. If they just waited a few more days.
Yeah. Well, this was my reaction when, you know, we had Paul Moser on to talk about it. But I went on NPR's Morning Edition right after it happened. And they were asking me about it, and it was tough to give an answer because I was saying, okay, well, you know, they're like, does this mean the end of Huawei? It's like, well, there's no way it can actually mean the end of Huawei because it's probably not going to be, they're probably not going to go through with all of it. And they're probably going to find ways around it. They're probably going to have lobbyists. You know, there's going to be lawyers. But yeah, the question is always exactly how it's going to affect them, but how much is it going to affect them? And who's, what parts is it going to affect? And that is, that's always been the tricky issue around it. So whenever people have been like, oh, this is a death sentence for Huawei, like this is, it's sensational.
Well, it is, I mean.
With all of this stuff, it's always going to get scaled back. It's what happened with ZTE. Right. It's that no one is willing to inflict that much pain. I think that's.
I mean, these.
Especially when our, the economies are so intertwined.
This looks, and you know, this looks more like a negotiating tactic now than it did a week ago.
Mm. Yeah.
But, yeah. You know, even a week ago, people were talking like, is it negotiable? We don't know. You never know until, you know. And even now, we don't really know, right? Like, what's going on? If anyone knows, please get in touch.
Right. Yeah. Twitter. Elliot Zagman, ELLIOTTZAAGMAN, James Hall X. Yeah, so it's always very confusing with this. I do wonder as well how much, and this is something I've always wondered with this, is how much of it is the U.S. national security establishment, you know, Pompeo, the generals, the broader kind of military industrial complex, these the quote unquote deep state, these processes that are far more institutional and that one decision can't really change, and how much of it is Trump, right? So I think in Trump's mind, Trump may be, you know, very interested in using Huawei as a trade chip. But the other question that I have is does Washington see it that way?
Yeah, there's a lot of...
And I don't know if they do.
It is a government with a lot of interests intertwined, and they're very exactly. Clear and usually pretty transparent about it. So it's, you can mm-hmm. tell there's, I mean, you can watch C-SPAN for a little bit and see,
right,
you know, how the views are, you know, spread out on just about anything. But yeah, for China, it seems
so the bigger question is where does power truly lie in Washington, and how much of it is in Trump? And it's hard to really know.
I mean, Trump can set the tone. He can scale it up, scale it down. You know, I don't know. Maybe he looks at these things as like tools in a kit, but I don't, yeah. Anyway, what's next?
Alibaba seems to be the 20 billion number that was getting thrown around. It now seems to be 10.
Yeah. I mean,
in the news reports
in all the previous press, whenever they said 20 billion, there was always a giant hedge right after it. So I was kind of wondering, maybe that's going to be lower. It's totally, it was not really based on anything, it seemed like, but it was mm-hmm. thrown out there.
And just for our listeners, this is the amount that they're looking to do a secondary listing in Hong Kong. And this is what we're
yeah,
talking about.
Yeah. But yeah, it looks like, they have filed. I think it's still confidential. So I guess at some point this year, I think, is the target. So we'll see.
Mm-hmm. Cool.
Yeah.
All right. Anything else before we get into our interview with Andrew Polk?
That's it. Just remind everyone that this was recorded on June 27th.
All right. We're going to go to our interview with Andrew Polk from Trivium China. Today, we will dig deep into China's macroeconomic situation. We will do so with Andrew Polk from Trivium China. He's a partner at Trivium China. Andrew, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me, guys. Appreciate it.
So, Andrew, can you tell our listeners a little bit more about what you do for a living at Trivium?
Yeah, so we're a strategic consultancy based in Beijing. We've been around for 2 years now, and we basically work with multinational companies and investors to figure out their China strategies. And that can take a bunch of different forms, whether it's sort of government relations or actually doing sort of some light level due diligence for deals, or just more general macro and market type research. I've been in China for the past 8 years, all doing macroeconomic research for various firms, working again with multinationals and investors. And I just decided to jump off with my two partners on our own about 2 years ago. And so far, things are going well.
So if you had to give kind of an elevator pitch or one or two sentence description of kind of how you would explain what you are advising clients or what you're working on these days, what is the theme of China's macroeconomic situation at the moment?
Yeah, well, I mean, obviously the trade war dominates a lot of stuff. And so there's a lot of uncertainty out there. People are, you know, wondering, is China opening? Is China closing? What's, you know, to foreign investment, you know, what's the role of the U.S.-China tensions in all of this? But sort of underneath all of those tensions, China's starting to realize that it's at risk of losing one what has been one of its longtime allies, which is the international business and investment communities, right? Because they've become more and more frustrated with Chinese trade and investment practices. And in reaction to that reality, a lot of the regulators have become much more practical and are saying, okay, we understand we need to do concrete market openings in order to continue to get FDI coming into this country. And so basically it's navigating, helping companies navigate those market openings, whether it be in the auto sector, or the financial sector, or oil and gas sector. So it's helping companies navigate that minefield. And that can be, like I said, take a range of specific research activity that we undertake or specific strategic advice that we give.
Yeah, so today we're going to talk about kind of the China's banking system, I guess, interbank system. There's a lot of kind of deep rabbit holes maybe we could get into. But before we get into any of them, you know, there's a lot of things are happening. There's been the takeover of the Baoshang Bank last year. But kind of could you help us set the context of our last month, did I say last year? Baoshang Bank last year. Could you help us set the context of, yeah, last month. I did it again.
Last month?
Feels like a year.
It's been
month.
A long
like
month.
A year.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly. Exactly.
It's China
right.
time. It's China time. China speed. Yeah.
So with the takeover of the Baoshang Bank last month, could you help us kind of set the context of, you know, what's happening here?
Yeah, I mean, so to really set the context, hopefully quickly, you really have to dial back all the way to the global financial crisis. I mean, China's response, of course, your listeners will be aware, to the global financial crisis was to ramp up this massive stimulus, largely through the banking system. And so in 2009, 2010, the growth of the banking system just exploded. It went vertical, and there was high growth in Chinese, you know, in the Chinese banking system and overall debt and in financial markets for basically a decade. There was a lot of financial volatility during the intervening years. And you sort of fast forward to 2017, and that's when regulators start to say, this can't go on forever. We need to start addressing some of these issues.
So what are some of the reasons? I mean, right when that happened, great financial crisis, I mean, there was, you could say for every dollar of debt they put in, they got a lot, or every RMB of debt they put in, they got quite a bit back in return. Whereas kind of later on, right, that sort of changed, mm-hmm. right? Was that part of the driver?
Well, exactly right. So they overinvested, right? So they were worried about their economy. They were worried, obviously, that the slowdown in the economy from, you know, due to the global financial crisis would give them a social stability issue. And it was something that they weren't willing to, you know, take a chance on. So they came out with this massive bazooka in terms of credit. And so they overinvested, right? So they dumped so much capital into the economy through the banking system that the return on that capital rapidly declined over the next few years. And in terms of what we're interested in now, the way that manifests in the banking system is that you now have, you know, a lot of non-performing assets in the banking system. That then translated into the worst of those assets are at the smaller banks in China. So the banking system's kind of tiered with the SOE banks and then some medium-sized banks called joint stock banks, and then about 130 city-level banks, which is where the real issue is right now, which is what Baoshang was. They were the ones with the highest NPLs, the biggest issues in terms of needing to raise capital. So they started borrowing a lot from the other banks, the bigger banks. And that's when you got this explosion in the interbank market, and where these small banks became heavily reliant on what they call wholesale funding, or basically interbank borrowing. So now you're in a situation
when exactly did we see this spike in interbank loans? Do we have like a time window that we could put that into?
Yeah, so 2012 was really where we start to, it coincided with the explosion of shadow lending, right? So you had a bunch of credit go out through the formal banking system, 2009, 2010. You fast forward about 3 years into 2012. That's when China's economy really started to feel a domestic slowdown, very, very rapid deterioration in growth. That's when you start to see a real concerted deterioration in returns on capital. And that's when companies start having to borrow outside the formal banking system from the shadow market, and when a lot of the smaller banks had to start borrowing from the bigger banks. So I really put the beginning of that sort of development at 2012. But okay. And then you fast forward to today, and all these banks have these crappy assets and need capital. But if you're a bank depositor, right, you sort of get this. And so you're going to go to the safe banks. You're going to go to ICBC. You're going to go to Bank of China, right? Put your money there. So the smaller banks not only have really bad assets, but they also don't have deposits coming in. So the only way they can, continue to get capital is by borrowing from the other banks. Hence why the interbank market becomes so important.
So to bring it forward a little bit, you know, there was this kind of deleveraging or kind of financial instability, kind of financial stability kind of campaign. When did that start, and kind of what was it? Was that significant?
Yeah, so we've started with the global financial crisis. Then we kind of went to 2012, where a lot of the shadow banking, interbank stuff happened. Next few years, you know, you still have high growth in interbank market and shadow lending and debt markets generally. And then you hit 2015, right? And in 2015 was just a really seminal year for Chinese economic policymakers. You had a huge spike in the stock market that year, over 100% growth in a few months, followed by the bursting of the bubble, right? Very difficult to stem the fallout of that. The economy was slowing rapidly. They did that mini devaluation of the currency, which, you know, scared everybody, and then tons of capital outflows. And so it was kind of at that point that policymakers led by now Vice Premier Liu He, who's kind of Xi Jinping's right-hand man in the economy, said, we got to do something. We got to come up with a new framework. They came up with supply-side structural reform, and that addressed a few of the issues over the next couple of years. And it was really, as a part of supply-side structural reform, one element of that is deleveraging, and they really emphasized that beginning in 2017. Now, they haven't actually deleveraged, so instead of calling it deleveraging, we prefer to call it de-risking. So it's really not about bringing down leverage. It's about sort of stemming the most speculative parts of the system. So we are always clear to call it a financial de-risking campaign. It was clear that sort of through that 2015-2016 process, Liu He got Xi Jinping's ear basically and said, listen, whatever you want to do on the political stage, rejuvenating China, all this stuff, it's not going to matter if the economy and the financial system blow up on your watch, because everything's going to be overshadowed by that. And then at the beginning of 2017, I think in March of that year, March or April, there was this, you know, People's Daily article about the original sin of high growth of debt and, you know, a debt addicted economy. And really that kind of it was written by Liu He. We now know that, but it was just a sort of a clear message to the system. Like we need to change. And so beginning of 2017, you really saw, an effort, very concerted effort to start to get control of some of this stuff. And so 2017 was the first year that we actually saw a contraction in interbank assets for the first time since 2010, because they first focused on getting control of this, of the interbank market, which is where a lot of the speculative activity was happening. And so 2017, 2018 were really pushing on this theme. In 2019, now the question is, how do we continue to consolidate gains from de-risking, but also address the fact that we have a slowing economy and this trade war on our hands? So now regulators are trying to thread that needle and part of that is how they dealt with Baoshang Bank.
Mm-hmm. So I have a couple questions here, though. One is I've read Denny McMahon's China's Great Wall of Debt, which I find very informative, and also just a really good, well-written book, a lot of good stories in there. But one of the points that he makes that stands out to me in the book is that he said that rather than liberalizing their economy, they chose to do supply-side structural reform. Right. Mm. And you also said rather than deleveraging, they chose to de-risk. So these are two terms that seem to sound similar, but are not quite so. How would you explain the differences between these concepts?
Between deleveraging and de-risking.
And also between the liberalization of the economy and supply side reform.
Yeah, so these are pretty complex issues.
Is this too much?
No. So to oversimplify, there's sort of two ways you could address the economic issues that they had, you know, or continue to have, really. One was through letting markets kind of sort things out themselves. So that would be the liberalization model, making sure that resources get to more productive places in the economy. Versus the state model, more state intervention, which is effectively what supply side structural reform is. And I think this being China, of course, they went with the state interventionist model. But the surprising thing has been actually how successful supply side structural reform has been over the past couple of years. And then within that is the de-risking. Deleveraging, quote unquote, deleveraging is one of the five elements of supply side structural reform. And I think on that one, it's a little bit different. I think the difference between de-risking and deleveraging is really deleveraging is a structural issue, right? You're actually bringing down debt in the economy, trying to improve the overall performance of assets throughout the system. And de-risking is more just about trying to stop the most speculative stuff. So in my view, it's sort of a, you know, crawl before you walk type of thing. You have to de-risk before you can deleverage. And so they just sort of started with the most immediate issues. But they've taken a lot of criticism because they've called it quote unquote deleveraging, and everyone can see that they're not actually deleveraging. And so, you know, a lot of economists say, well, you're not reducing debt, but you know, that's not really what they're trying to do. They're trying to stabilize debt by de-risking the system first.
Right, because when you look at it from a national level, you know, the level of debt that you have doesn't matter. It is the exposure that you have to risk and the potential that one shock could bring the whole system down.
Exactly. And I think most economists agree that levels of debt do matter, but, you know, there's a debate around what level that is. But what I think most people agree on is that what matters more than the level is the pace of debt accumulation. Mm. And China was accumulating debt very fast from 2010 to 2017 through the end of 2016. And now the pace of debt accumulation has slowed dramatically, basically flatlined in terms of debt to GDP 2017 and 2018, which is good progress. Again, you got to crawl before you can walk. You can't bring down debt before you stabilize the debt.
Can you give us an example of a way in which they have shut down risk? So, for example, the P2P lending, would that be the way that kind of was cracked down upon?
So that's definitely that. Just greater oversight in financial markets. So one of the things that they've done is they've really, you know, they've written new rules around asset management, which is more popularly known as wealth management products. And wealth management products were sold, you know, they were sort of, banks would and non-bank financial institutions would raise money from often small-time investors and then invest that money in speculative stuff that, you know, the investor often didn't know what it was. So a lot of it was going into, you know, real estate and Gansu, you know, stuff that no one in their right mind would invest in, but the investors were getting, you know, high returns. And so the regulators basically said, listen, only 35% of these wealth management products can be invested outside effectively anything but the safest money market instruments and, you know, state government bonds. So they just, and that had always been a rule, but they started enforcing those rules. So that's kind of, you know, an example of how they said, all right, we're actually going to make you invest this money in safer assets. And that has brought down returns, which investors don't like, but it's made the system safer.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. Returns used to, how high were returns on some of these products? With like,
yeah, high single digits. You're pushing, you know, 2012, investing in an 8% wealth management product. And, you know, everyone knew it was speculative, but they were getting an 8%, you know, every 3 months. And they knew they'd be bailed out. They knew because there was so much moral hazard in the system. If a bank, especially a bank wealth management product, went bad, there was so much reputational risk at stake. The bank would have to bail out the investors. Otherwise, they'd lose all their other investors. And so, you know, these were basically risk-free products at 8%. You'd be crazy not to invest in it.
So that was kind of also referred to as like the implicit guarantee.
Exactly.
And so does de-risking, so I guess, I forget when it was, but recently they've talked about how banks have to move their wealth management or asset management companies outside of the, as a separate entity, right? Is that kind of maybe setting up the, you know, the setting the table for potential to allow a couple of those to fail, to kind of break the implicit guarantee, you know, problem that China kind of talks about every now and then?
Yeah. So hopefully, I mean, you know, in terms of introducing more discipline into the system, so that process is ongoing. So it was, you know, the new asset management rules came to effect late last year. The first major banks got their approval to set up asset management subsidiaries in late 2018. The first two asset management subsidiaries just started operation this month. So it's all kind of in flux. But the overall question, and again, this goes back to Baoshang Bank, which we can talk about in a minute, is how do you introduce, this is a perennial problem with Chinese financial system. How do you introduce risk or introduce counterparty risk, right? Or discipline into the system in a controlled way? Or how do you remove moral hazard in a controlled way? So the issue is, if you let what everyone's worried about is, if you let one product fail, well, then everyone think that their product's not safe. And then you get a run on the banks or you run on wealth management products, and regulators in that case would effectively bring on the very crisis they're trying to avert, right? So how do you introduce, you know, discipline into a system where there's been none?
So then why Baoshang? Like, why is Baoshang the chicken that they kill to scare the monkeys?
I don't think they wanted to. I think that it was sort of a perfect storm. So Baoshang, everyone's known it's been a bad bank for a long time. It basically stopped publishing, you know, annual statements or quarterly statements a couple of years ago. And that's like definitely a red flag, is if a bank in China just stops producing financial statements, then you know there's an issue. And so it was well known to have, you know, bad assets. It was well known to be highly exposed to the interbank market. And it also had this other sort of political element where it was owned by Tomorrow Holdings, which was a group that was owned by a Chinese billionaire living in Hong Kong, who was kind of well known as a white glove who would help, you know, connected Chinese people get their money out of China. He, a couple of years ago, got snatched up by the government and hasn't been heard of since. So there was a political element to unwind this guy's financial assets anyway. And so I think the regulators had Baoshang extra on their radar because it was a bad bank and it was connected to sort of this political malfeasance. And in terms of the timing, we don't know the exact reason that it happened on May 24th, 2019, but sounds like Baoshang could not make good on one of its interbank liabilities. And so regulators felt like they had to step in and take the bank over. And so the way that they've tried to introduce risk, right? So they bailed out 99.98% of Baoshang's creditors. And that 0.2% that they didn't bail out is freaking everyone out.
Right? So wow.
This is how big the problem is. Yeah.
Exactly. So they tried to introduce this tiny bit of risk and say, you know, you might not get your money back. Everything's not guaranteed. And that tiny bit has really exposed deeper issues in the financial system and in the interbank market. Now, everyone in the interbank market is saying, well, wait a second, I'm carrying, or I lent to a bank similar to Baoshang, and now I'm not sure if that bank is going to be able to make good on its, you know, its liabilities to me. So that tiny bit of introducing discipline has had significant reverberations. And I think regulators, it's not like they're being heroic by doing this. I think they had to take Baoshang over. They wanted to try to not do a full-on bailout, but it's, you know, 0.2 or 0.02% is not, you know.
It's basically
It's basically a full-on bailout, right?
Is the kind of significance of that 0.02%, is that, I mean, does it, like, is do these interbank kind of loans and or whatever that small piece is, do they get kind of resold and kind of spread out, and then you get kind of a multiplier effect on them?
Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, one of the big issues right now is
it's almost like it's like the CDOs and the housing crisis and the financial crisis in the U.S.
Exactly. So, one of the big issues now is through these very complex structures, SMEs, small and medium sized enterprises, are issuing these things called structured deposits. So it's basically how they're issuing bonds, and they're being required. So the small banks are buying the bonds of these small companies, but they're requiring the small companies to also purchase some of their own bonds. And then the small bank then sells those bonds on to someone else, a non-bank financial institution. And through very complex structures, those SME bonds end up as collateral in the interbank market, but disguised as much higher quality instruments. And the Baoshang episode kind of really revealed this practice. And so everyone's now saying, well, are the bonds that I'm holding in the interbank market backed by this crappy collateral? And it is very similar, obviously, to what happened in the global financial crisis. And that's why just the tiniest bit of, you know, volatility can have big reverberations. And so there's a lot of banks and non-banks in the interbank market, which is ironic that there's non-banks in the interbank market, but that's another issue, reassessing their lending into the market. And even to the extent that a lot of the small banks, or not a lot, but some number of these smaller banks have been blacklisted and no one will lend to them anymore. And that's creating a real problem, right? Because there's liquidity in the system, but it's not getting to the places that the central bank wants it to go. And so that's what's driving a lot of the nervousness.
Can we go into those? What's driving, like, why are they, some of these banks blacklisted? And who are they blacklisted by? Is it blacklisted by the market participants, or is it like a central PBOC sort of thing?
Yeah, so it's by the market participants, and the regulators are trying to ask. So when the PBOC and the banking regulator, the CBIRC, took over Baoshang, the market reaction was, is this a one-off or is this the first domino in a chain? And the regulators have been pains to say this was a Baoshang-only thing. It was related to Tomorrow Holdings. The Tomorrow Holdings was using Baoshang as its individual piggy bank. But everybody knows that the issues that Baoshang had are replicated at other city-level banks. And so no one knows if there's going to be another Baoshang soon. And so people basically the market participants don't believe the regulators. The way the interbank system basically works is that the PBOC lends money primarily to the biggest 30 banks in the system. So the SOE banks and to some extent the joint stock banks. There are some others, but those are the primary ones. And then those banks lend on to smaller banks and or the brokerages who are in the interbank system as well. And then the brokerages and the smaller banks lend on to smaller non-bank financial institutions. So there's a tiered system within the interbank market. So the money's kind of gotten stuck at the top of the system, right? If you're ICBC or you're one of these big brokerages like CITIC, you're saying, I don't want to lend to X bank. And so there's sort of been this, I mean, I don't know who's on the blacklist, but, you know, there's some of the small banks have basically been shut out of the market. And so the regulators are trying to say, they're trying to set up a blind auction system, basically, so mm-hmm. that the bigger banks don't and brokerages don't know who they're lending to.
They don't know if they're buying garbage or if they're buying good stuff. Okay. It's a grab bag.
Is that so? Are you talking about the anonymous auctions that I think they were launched on June 17th?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Those hide the name of the counterparty that's defaulted, but
exactly
can you still see what you're buying, but you just don't know who you're buying it from.
So I mean the details are still not fully right. clear. My understanding is that so there's a defaulted pledged repo, right. so that's a type of interbank contract. When that when that contract defaults, then the owner of it, so the bigger bank, the lending party, then wants to get rid of that contract, but no one will buy it because it's a Baoshang or whoever who still owes on it. And so the contract is sent through a blind auction for anybody who wants to pick up the contract, i.e. lend again to the smaller bank. That's my understanding of how it works, but system hasn't been implemented yet.
So I'm gonna put out a kind of a narrative here, and I want you to tell me if you think it's right or if you think it's wrong or what you think about it. Mm. Is that when I see this, what I see is there was a we have a, especially on local city level or provincial level banks, we have a lot of bad debt on the books and a lot of banks that probably are in trouble. Mm-hmm. And we have one of them that was allowed to fail partly because of the kind of the corruption issues of the man in charge, but allowed to fail in a way that was very much protected by the regulators. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And they let just a little bit out of this dam and people are freaking out of what kind of water is behind it. Mm-hmm. So what are the knock-on effects of this when it comes to the broader financial system within China and when it comes to, the average consumer as well?
Yeah. So we're not quite sure, to be honest. So again, to put things in context, one of the bigger economic priorities right now is to get more financing to the private sector. And regulators have really been pushing that since sort of mid-2018, so for the past year. And it's really been an uphill battle because the banking system is not set up well to lend to private sector, small private sector players. But regulators have finally realized, like, actually, the private sector drives a lot of economic activity in China. So rather than pumping up investment, this time around, we're going to try to lend more to the private sector. A lot of the way they were doing that was through the smaller banks. And now if the small banks can't get cash to fund themselves, they definitely can't lend to the private sector. So this potentially exacerbates the economic issues that are already happening because the private sector is not going to, it's only going to worsen the private sector's ability to get funding.
So if you're a manufacturer in Zhejiang, for example, and you're already getting hit by tariffs on one end, right? What you need is a line of credit. Mm-hmm. And on the other end, you have banks that correct me if I'm wrong, but might now be less likely to lend to you.
They were already not very likely to lend to you, but they were being pushed by regulators to do so. But now they may be unable to lend to you because okay. they can't get financing themselves, right? So it may that's exactly right. If you're some small player an exporter, you're getting hit both by tariffs and the inability to get credit. And this may get worse now, sort of in the second half of the year, because we'll see how long these reverberations last. So last time we had sort of an interbank issue, it was 2013. There was a 2013 cash crunch, sort of different reasons, but kind of similar outcome. And for the next 3 or 4 months, credit growth slowed dramatically. And so, if this causes the banking system overall to kind of become more cautious and lend less, then you're going to have less lending in an already decelerating economy that's in the midst of a trade war. And that's not a good situation.
Yeah. I mean, because another problem is a lot of the the loans that are kind of out there, they're not like the structure of the loans, you know, like, I mean, you can look at the amount and say, okay, this is amount is not that it's, you know, it's too high, but then you can also look at the structure and, you know, like the duration of the loans. When are these, you know, a lot of these loans in China are unfortunately short term. You know, if you get to the point, if you're a small business in Zhejiang, right, and you're getting hit by tariffs, you know, you're trying to get paid from suppliers or whatever, and there's all these things, you need to roll over your loan at the when it comes to maturity, or even, you know, get ready to do so beforehand. If you can't then access, you know, the banking, or the banks can't service you, you know, that adds an extra layer of just kind of liquidity tightening, liquidity crunching. And this is why liquidity for all financial crises, basically forever, liquidity has been a key piece of the, you know, the puzzle, right?
Yeah, totally. And that's why the central bank tends to be very cautious around the interbank market, because they know this. They're like, we will deal with the you know, the bad assets in the system. We will try to get banks to behave better, but the one thing we're not going to do is, you know, overly tighten liquidity, because exactly as you say, when liquidity gets too tight, you bring on the crisis you're trying to avert. And so I think, you know, outside of China, or maybe not even outside of China, even within China, the regulators have just been very on top of this issue over the past month, because they're concerned about the fallout. And because they've been so proactive, they've handled it reasonably well. But if they make a misstep, it definitely can be disastrous. And so, you know, I'm quite concerned and watching it closely.
Right. Me too.
And I'm not sure how you know, your average investor is, how closely they're tracking it, and how, you know, if they deal with it well, then it's obviously not an issue.
Yeah.
But we're very close to a big issue. And so I don't want to oversell, like, how that China's on the precipice or anything like that. But this needs to be on people's radar for sure.
So usually one of the ways, like, kind of liquidity can, or at least risk, gets implemented in, you know, or handled in a market is you look at kind of yield spreads or yield premiums. And one of the things we've seen, and, you know, I've read, Bloomberg's been writing a lot about it, but is that the yields on the NCDs, the negotiable certificates of deposits that are kind of part of this interbank lending market, they've been kind of widening. And, you know, that's, they've kind of gone up, you know, between AAA to AA plus, they've gone up from, you know, looking like an average of like 15 basis points difference to like 70 basis points difference. And usually, I mean, you look at a chart of these things, you see them spike up and down, you know, reasonably periodically. Although right now, this spread seems to be higher than they have been in the last 4 years, at least.
Mm-hmm.
So is this, do you know, if there is a repricing of risk, which would be, you know, this is an indicator of, would this be something that you'd expect to stick around? Is it or is it more like a one-off, and we should go back to kind of, you know, all the pricing of risk is pretty tight and close? Or could we be seeing like a real, you know, like some a real sort of stratification or separation of, yeah.
Yeah, I do think, you know, the risk premium will probably come down somewhat, but each time this happens, we do get these episodes sort of periodically in China, in the financial system, in the bond market. And it does help to introduce counterparty risk. And that's what makes those spreads widen and helps to actually build a legitimate yield curve, right? And so I would expect that, you know, spreads do stay elevated, you know, rightly so. Like AA negative paper should be more expensive than AAA paper, right? So I'm sure there will be some reversion, but in general, I think lenders and investors, you know, domestic investors are starting to understand that some of the implicit guarantees are being broken. The government is trying to step back from bailing everybody out, and that they do have to price risk more effectively. Is it gonna, you know, happen in a day? No, but each one of these episodes makes domestic institutional investors become more disciplined and do more work to price risk appropriately. So I would say I think those spreads will stay elevated, but they might compress some from where they are now because everyone's, you know, more on edge than, you know, than usual.
So let's talk about usually what we discuss in this podcast has more to do with the tech industry, you know, your Alibabas, your Tencents, your ITEs, Baidus, et cetera, et cetera. So how a lot of these companies have, you know, their operating cash flow is fairly healthy. They're listed abroad, or when they do get funding, if they're not listed yet, then you know they get it from you know some sovereign wealth fund somewhere or whatever. It's not coming from the Chinese banking system, but they're certainly impacted by it. So how if you're an Alibaba or if you're an iQIYI or if you're even some of these smaller listed Chinese tech companies, or if you're a shareholder in them. Why should you be concerned about the situation with interbank lending in China?
Well, there's a few reasons. One reason you shouldn't be concerned is that, you know, the pricier credit is in China or the harder credit is to get, the more these companies are going to have to borrow overseas. So that's better for foreign investors, right? They get to come in at better rates and hopefully offer more financing to these companies. So that, you know, in general should be a good thing for foreign investors. More broadly, it concerns them just like it should concern everyone is if China's going to have a financial crisis, which I don't really think it is, but if it is, it's going to emanate from the interbank market. So that needs to be on your radar because if China has a financial crisis leading to a sharp economic slowdown, everybody's going to be in trouble, right? Your customers aren't going to be able to buy from you. The business environment's going to clamp up, so you're not going to be able to sell B2B. I mean, no one wants to go through a financial or economic crisis. So that needs to be on the radar. And it's just a general macro risk for, you know, for investors in specific companies to be aware of. And then the last piece on sort of the Tencents and Alibabas of the world is that as this plays out, I mean, obviously, Alibaba and Tencent are really pushing hard to become fintech companies, right? They emphasize the tech, right? Exactly. So they emphasize the tech, but they're very much financial companies. And regulators in the past couple of years have said, well, wait a minute, these guys are now some of the biggest financial institutions in the country, and we don't regulate them as financial institutions. And so the more that regulators see risk in the financial system and try to clamp down on risk on the financial system, the more their sights are going to be on Alibaba and Tencent to make sure that they have various, you know, capital cushions and other prudential measures, macro-prudential measures put in place. So I think Alibaba and Tencent are going to kind of be squeezed in terms of profitability through this process.
Yeah. They both have their wealth management sort of like, I don't know what to call them, but arms, you know, with Alibaba has Yuebao and WeChat has their own, you know, thing in the wallet. You can put your money in and get a little rate of return. And that money doesn't just sit in an account somewhere. That money's doing things. And,
right.
You know, it's busy out there providing liquidity to the system, and it'll get, you know, if there is a giant liquidity tightening, you know, it might be wrapped up there. So if we talk about financial crisis, we got to also talk a little bit about kind of if one did happen, what tools does the PBOC and I guess the regulators in general, what could they deploy in kind of staving it off and how quickly could they do so? You know, and obviously the hard part is they don't want to drive back the implicit guarantee, you know. So
right.
It's a
yeah. Yeah. Well, yeah, no. I mean, the biggest, you know, tool that any central bank has in my view is to offer liquidity directly to the market. So
balance sheet.
Exactly. And so right now,
but they've already done so much of that.
Yeah, so I mean, but
how much more room does the PBOC have?
Well, I think, well, I mean, they...
I mean, some people would say...
They basically have unlimited room. So, I mean, we hope that in a day-to-day scenario that they are cautious with their balance sheet, right? And that they are generally trying to make sure that liquidity is, you know, is ample enough, but not overly abundant so that, you know, bad loans are made. So I think in normal times, we hope they're fairly cautious with their balance sheet. But if we get to, yeah, I mean, I think we're talking about the hypothetical of the financial crisis. If we get to that, then the PBOC absolutely should go all out to leverage its balance sheet. What they can effectively do is, so they have, I think they set it up in 2013, something called the standing lending facility, which is effectively their version of the discount window at the Federal Reserve, which means any bank can come who has access to the standing lending facility, the SLF, can come and get as much money as they need directly from the central bank, but they pay a price for it. Right now, I'm not sure the exact number off the top of my head. I want to say there's 45 banks or so that have access to the SLF. What they could just do is say, everybody has access to the SLF. And they could, I mean, there's thousands of banks in China when you get down to the rural lenders, and they could just say, we are opening this facility to everybody. Now, there are technical aspects of how you get them the money, like, you know, just a bank out and a rural commercial lender, you know, Gansu, have the technical capabilities to get wire transfers from, you know, the central bank. We don't know that. I mean, so there are some issues. But this is exactly what the European Central Bank did in the crisis, is they basically just opened their direct lending to a greater number of banks. So the PBOC could do that.
The Fed did that too.
Exactly.
Adding even international banks to
exactly that. Right. So if we get to that point, that's a pretty powerful tool PBOC's got. And I think, so, you know, the question is, you know, can they execute it if you get the technical aspects I talked about? So the big banks will be fine. In a crisis, you're going to have some problems at the smaller banks if they can't, like the really small ones. But we're talking about, like, these banks are like
rural cooperative. Those
exactly. And they're like, you know, those things are so small in comparison to the size of the system. Like, literally, you're talking about 0.001% of the banking system on an individual basis, right? So, like, if a few of those go down, it's not a systemic issue.
Okay. And what, I guess this is maybe the big $64,000 question, but, you know, if an investor was trying to figure out a way to hedge this, and or to take, say, this risk exists, and okay, how do you stay invested in China and aware of this risk and try to hedge it? You know, like what would you recommend? Is there something out there that's, you know, available to?
Yeah, I mean, right now it's tough. There's not a lot of ways. I mean, you know, CDS, credit default swaps, are starting to get a little bit of traction in China. You know, most investors don't have direct exposure to China. So, like, the most direct way to do it is just short the currency or just leave China alone. But the real issue is, you know, if China has a real big financial or economic problem, it's going to have reverberations throughout the rest of the world. Fed's going to be easing. ECB's going to be easing. Stock markets are going to be, you know, jittery, if not outright contracting. So, yeah, I mean, how do you hedge against a full-on crisis? It's tough. I don't think you have the same
gold.
Yeah,
buy exactly. Gold.
Buy gold.
Gold or Bitcoin or
this is what Glenn Beck tells me.
Yeah,
but what
the VIX? I guess.
What I do want to. So the more likely scenario here you mentioned earlier, right, is that the short either you could short the Chinese currency or just leave China alone, mm-hmm. and. This seems to be what more and more investors will be choosing to do. And if we're projecting for a year in the future, I think we can probably safely assume that this is going to be the strategy for a lot of more prudent financial managers. So what can we expect to see if that is the general trend for the next at least year or so? From the Chinese economy? What are the knock-on effects or downstream effects of that?
Yeah, that's a good question. And I just want to be clear, I don't expect China to have a financial crisis. In some ways, we're talking in you know, hypotheticals. Yeah, I mean,
hypotheticals.
My thinking on this is always that they're far less likely to have a crisis and more likely to just be end up being frozen.
It's a good question. So first, you know, foreign investment, especially on the portfolio side, is still relatively small in terms of the overall financial system, right? So the numbers are big because it's China, but, you know, in the bond market, it's like 5 or 6% of bonds are owned by foreign investors. So if, you know, they all flee, it's a big hole to fill, but it's not, you know, the PBOC can deal with 5%, right? So the challenge for China, I think, and Chinese regulators, is to cut through the noise, like I was saying kind of at the beginning of the podcast, and to say, listen, like, we hear the complaints of the foreign investment community, and we're going to try to continue opening our markets to you, you know, so that you have opportunities here. And I think they're definitely, because of the trade war, a lot of investors are very nervous about investing in China. But, you know, Chinese regulators are trying to say to increase connectivity, right? We just have the Shanghai-London link, you know, start, I think, on Monday. And so they're trying to show concrete opening measures to continue to get foreign investors interested, even despite all the uncertainty. And I think on top of that, I think there's, you know, two other things. One, we're still in a fairly low yield world, right? So people are looking for yield, and, you know, China's interest rates are higher than, you know, US and Europe and Japan. So that's one place you can get yield. But also, like, I think the you know, the smart investors, some of whom we talk to, are, you know, obviously they have a need for short-term returns, but they're looking, they understand that the Chinese financial system is kind of the story of the next decade. Right. And the more you can be a first mover in figuring out how to get exposure to it in a relatively safe manner, the more you're going to be ahead of the game. So I think there's still a long-term play there as well. So investors have to be understanding, like, China is going to become more and more an integral part of the global financial system. Its financial system itself is going to become, you know, more and more developed, and there will be more and more ways to make money here. And so you have to keep a long-term view, but that doesn't mean you go and put 50% of your portfolio in China tomorrow, right? You want to inch that exposure up over time. And the reality is, a lot of people are having to do that because of things like bond inclusion and index inclusion, where, you know, money managers have a mandate to hit the MSCI, you know, emerging market index, right? And so they're having to get more China exposure. So I think China's taking enough steps on the opening side and the connectivity side to keep investors from fleeing wholesale.
Also, just in crises, I mean, those are usually very good opportunities. So even hypothetical crises and times when things are jittery, you know, sometimes those yield good opportunities to invest or to start to nibble.
Right.
So, you know, one of the, you know, we're talking about a lot of kind of negative stuff, but, like, one of the more positive developments that has happened is on June 18th, there was these things called the SBLC, Standby Letter of Credit, which were issued a lot more often back in, like, 2013, 2014, but they had their first kind of test, and it was about $304 million. And basically what happened is Minsheng, a group under Minsheng Investment Group, defaulted on their loan. And so this standby letter of credit, which was given by China Construction Bank, basically says that if there's a default, we'll step in and pay creditors, pay the lenders. And they did. And they did it reasonably quickly. I think they asked for the SBLC to be honored, and then within 4 days they basically got it. This is super positive for any companies that are issuing dollar bonds, any Chinese companies that are issuing dollar bonds. I think there was speculation maybe in the kind of more hawkish, you know, China watcher groups that China dollar bondholders would basically be just left out to dry. And this is a really, I don't know, to me, this is a great thing.
Yeah, I would say a couple things. One is, you know, foreign investors, you know, especially people who are offering dollar credit to Chinese companies,
right,
do have a history of getting burned, right? You know, domestically, investors tend to get bailed out, but the foreigners always, you know, are left holding the bag. And so, you know, it's understandable that there is this concern. But I think what China's trying to do generally is introduce controlled default mechanisms. Like, and this is an example of one. And it worked well, and it didn't cause a massive, you know, financial volatility, right? You know, the default happened, the guarantee was paid, and everyone moves on with their life. And that's how it should work. The problem is that Chinese regulators, especially on domestic, in a domestic environment, have just considered defaults to be so evil that, you know, no one's defaulted for years and years and years because they always get bailed out. But defaults are good. It helps people, price risk. It helps, you know, the interest rates to be, you know, accurate. I mean, interest rates are prices. The prices should reflect something. In this case, they should reflect credit risk, right? And so defaults aren't bad. They actually help to put some discipline on the system. And controlled defaults, you know, make market mechanisms work. It's when you have uncontrolled defaults that there's an issue, or no defaults. And China's been on the no default side and trying to get to the controlled default side. And it's a process. Like, literally, a lot of this is like, you know, they don't have the right legal mechanisms in force in some instances. It's why companies don't go bankrupt, because there aren't enough bankruptcy lawyers, for example. So it's China, in many senses, China is building the regulatory apparatus around its financial system from scratch. So it just takes time.
Huh. Which, I mean, isn't that how it's gone everywhere, though? I mean, even in the US, it had to be kind of figured out over time, evolutionary kind of process.
But did the U.S. ever have a this long of a period where basically they had a no default policy?
No, they didn't. You know, but the U.S. was never a state driven, communist led economy.
Yeah.
And so, but you know, the U.S. just, they figured it out in the early 1900s when they set up the central bank. But then, you know, obviously 1930s, they had the Great Depression and massive financial volatility. And it's definitely been a learning process. The U.S. just got a much bigger head start. Remember, like, the PRC was founded 70 years ago, 1949, right? So, and, you know, I forget when their central bank law was instituted, but I think it was like, you know, late 90s, early 2000s. I could get that wrong. But, you know, central bank hasn't been around that long. So I think we just...
Even the U.S. had more than... I had a couple goes at central banks. I don't think it was just... There were some mess ups and then some scrap it all and then redo, you know.
You had Hamilton that established it. I know because I saw the musical. But then also, was it Jackson, Andrew Jackson, that took it down again? And then they didn't set up another bank until, you know, decades, a long time later. But, but what I do wonder, I mean, I don't know how you're going to answer this question, but we have had, at least when we talk about general macro issues, you know, we've had some more hawkish folks on this show, right? And the hawkish folks also tend to be the more vocal folks, right? So we've had Ann Stevenson Young on, we've had Chris Balding on. So these are people who are, you know, they tend to be sending out the message of, you know, the collapse is going to happen one of these days, right? From what I hear from you is you don't think that the crisis is going to happen. You don't think that collapse is going to happen.
No,
I don't know if you would call it the bullish argument, but the what is your argument to the bears?
Yeah, so a couple of things. One is, I mean, the ground's really shifted. So, you know, in 2012, when I was talking, I spoke before about, you know, we sensed a very clear economic deceleration. And at that time, I was at the conference board and we were saying growth is really 4%, not the 7% that they're saying it is. And, you know, I was labeled as a bear because I was saying growth was slow and that China had a growth problem. And fast forward to today, and my story is growth is slower than the official numbers and China has a growth problem, but it's not about to collapse. Same story, but now I'm a bull, right? And it just shows you how much the kind of conversation has shifted, largely because of the 2015 volatility when everyone thought, oh, this is China's real crisis moment. It's about to happen. So my view on China's macro story, I think, is one of the big strengths and weaknesses of the system is how, of the economy, is how disconnected it is. So, you know, we've had actually a recession in Dongbei. I mean, they're coming out of it, but from 2015 to 2018, that place was in legit recession. The rest of the economy didn't really feel it. You know, so this is an economy that's literally a continent. It's got a fifth of the world's population. And so analyzing it from a macro standpoint is very hard. It's like saying, what's growth in Europe look like? Well, growth in Germany is very different from growth in Portugal. And so
What is growth in the Americas look like?
Exactly. So, you know, I tend to think about China from a more granular aspect. And I think there are places like the Northeast and some of the poorer provinces where things are not going well. But I mean, just go to Shenzhen. Like Guangdong is the size of Germany's economy, right? And it is extremely dynamic. It's got high-tech manufacturing in Guangzhou. It's got, you know, proximity to Hong Kong. It's got, you know, all the tech investment in Shenzhen. Very dynamic economy. And, you know, at already high levels of per capita GDP. Same with Shanghai. Same with Beijing. And so, you know, there's enough dynamism in the dynamic places that I think, you know, China's underlying growth story is still pretty decent, even if it's at slower growth rates than, you know, the 6% official number. And so what I expect is sort of isolated, you know, localized mini MINI crises, right? So the Dongbei crisis, you could call it that. But that doesn't, but because of the disjointedness of both the economy and the financial system, it never kind of takes on it never really metastasizes nationwide. And the one caveat to that would be if the interbank market blows up, right? To take it back to this conversation today. And I think the PBOC is so focused on making sure the interbank market doesn't blow up that that's their real guard against a systemic issue. And so that's my story, is not that, you know, China is going to zoom back up to 10% growth, but that you go under the hood and there's pockets of really crappy growth, and there's pockets of really dynamic, high value add, innovative growth.
Okay. Yeah. And I guess just to, I feel like we could talk for much longer, but just to kind of wrap it up a little bit, you know, where, if you want to focus on the growth and those pockets, like, where would you say, you know, are there specific industries or specific areas that you're more optimistic that could be more favorable for investors' portfolios? Obviously not investment research or investment advice, but yeah.
You know, what we tend to do is look at regulatory goals and say, you got to align with those, especially in areas where the government is trying to achieve a goal that they don't have the resources to do. So, and I think it's not rocket science, honestly. Like, they're trying to build an NEV market, right? So there's definitely going to be, they're pouring a bunch of money into fuel cell technology, right? They are obviously trying to win in AI. And more importantly, I think than AI, because I think that's difficult for foreign investors to get into, is the Internet of Things. So connected, so not only NEVs, but smart cars, connected cars. That's going to be a huge growth area. Another place is, I mean, the fundamental thing you need to frame your China outlook on is the demographic picture, right? So they have massive need for elderly care services and healthcare services, right? And they know that, you know, technology needs to be a part of that. And they know that private sector and foreign players need to be a part of it. So they have a demographic issue that they need to fix, and they're willing to let foreigners help out. Boom. That's where I'd be looking to invest. I think it's quite simple. when you think about it through that kind of frame.
Yeah, good. I had a conversation with a VP at Goldman Sachs probably 7 years ago, and I said, you know, what area would be, you know, do you think is the best bet for investment in China? And he said, well, you know, real estate, you know, can go up or down depending on regulation. You know, steel, infrastructure, all that stuff goes up or down depending on what the regulators and the banks want. But nothing's going to stop Chinese people from getting older.
Exactly.
And
but man, real estate and so was healthcare a good investment is where it's at. 7 years ago too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Anyways, okay, and Andrew, thank you so much for coming on. James, do you have anything else we want to say to Andrew before we let him go?
Yeah. How can people find you? You know, are you on Twitter? How can people find Trivium?
Yeah, thanks. We're at triviumchina.com, and I would say our Twitter presence is lacking at the moment. But you know, for people who are interested, we do put out a daily newsletter, free, totally free, and it's very short to read. We keep it snappy, kind of 5 to 7 must know things that happened in China that day. We cover politics, policy, and economics with businesses and investors in mind. And I think, you know, it's drives a lot of the conversation in Beijing among the business and diplomatic community, and to some extent the investor community here as well. So, you know, go sign up for the tip sheet on our website. And I think that's it's a pretty good resource to wrap your brain around what's happening in China on a day-to-day basis.
Do you want people to follow you on your personal Twitter or LinkedIn or anything like that?
Yeah, what is my Twitter? Probably not worth the follow.
Anyways, Andrew Polk, thank you so much for joining us and for being on the China Tech Investor Podcast.
Thanks, Andrew.
Thank you, guys. Appreciate it. Have a good one.
Thanks again to Andrew Polk from Trivium China. That was a great conversation. I really enjoyed it. Be sure to subscribe to techno.com/newsletters. You can also subscribe to Techno's subscription service and get in on our Slack feed, in which we have a lot of good conversations. You can also follow us on Twitter. That's me at Elliot Zagman, ELLIOTTZAAGMAN. James at James Hull X, JAMESHULLX. And also give us some good feedback on iTunes or Overcast or wherever you get your podcast. You can give us a comment, give us a 5-star review, please. That's very, very helpful in helping people find our podcast. James, what are you looking forward to this week?
So I'm looking forward to 4th of July and some time at the beach.
All right. In America?
With my family in the U.S.
Nice.
Yeah. Very much looking forward to that. And after that, I'll be in New York for about 5 days or so.
I'm in, like I mentioned earlier, I'm in Michigan right now. Great. I love Michigan in the summer. So like my family, my great grandfather built a summer house on Lake Michigan. So very little has changed, but it's about 100 years old. But it's wonderful. It's a great kind of childhood, kind of family. There's a lot of memories in this place. It's really nice. But yeah, and then we're going to go, I'm going to go to Boston, you know, kind of see some more family over there for 4th of July, which is always nice. But yeah, summer in the northern U.S. is just wonderful. I love it. Although after being in Asia, you know, spending most of my time in Asia, like China and Thailand, you know, the food, man, I just can't really get into like the hot dogs and, you know, it's just not like American food. Yep. Just doesn't stack up to Asia. But you know, there are plenty of other good things. And what's great about America is that you can get really whatever kind of food you want.
Well, the corn dogs though are better.
Corn dog. Hot dogs. Well, we have. I'm not a corn dog fan because in where I'm from. Okay, so we spent our summers at a place called Grand Haven, Michigan. Right. In Grand Haven, Michigan, it's about 45 minutes west of Grand Rapids. It's right on the lakeshore in Lake Michigan.
Everything's grand up there.
Everything's grand. It's a grand place, man. And they have this something called Prano Pups, right? So they use like pancake batter rather than corn batter. And it's delicious. And also, every time I have a corn dog, I hate it because it's not a Prano Pup. Anyway, so if anyone ever wants to go to West Michigan, they can go to Grand Haven and have a Prano Pup. As for what I'm looking forward to this week, I am going to be keeping my eyes and ears peeled to hear more about how the Huawei ban is going to be changed, right? So are we going to see, for example, Huawei being able to use Android again? Is this something that we can or at least use Google services again? Is this something that we can expect? What about as far as the chips?
I got a question for you. Do you think kind of the more hawkish, people will kind of quiet down after this?
What do you mean?
Like just sort of after a truce, maybe they'll like kind of tone it down a notch, or do you think they'll still keep going?
Like a Rubio, like that kind of guy?
Yeah. Those types of guys.
I think, well, that's the big question. So I think the question would be if we see more noise from Rubio, then that would be an indication that, Trump, had a good time at the G20, but Washington doesn't like him. If we see, Trump or Rubio and Schumer and some of these more hawkish, leaders towards China, kind of calm down their rhetoric, then it's an indication that they're happier with the situation. So that's something to pay attention to. Also, I think we're going to see, hopefully, markets go up next week if this deal actually seems to be going in a positive direction.
Based on what we, what we talked about with Andrew, and these kind of, I don't know, what's the right word to use, funky stuff going on in the interbank market, this might be a very good thing for Chinese markets as well, to kind of let some steam, maybe it's sentiment related, maybe, people will kind of feel better and businesses will feel better. Confidence goes up a little bit. Maybe not. I don't know. We'll see. Sentiment's a hard thing to predict.
And fluctuation on these Chinese tech stocks has really been crazy. When I'm looking at just kind of, there's my own kind of watch list that I have, it's always the Alibabas and the Tencents that within a couple of months, they're going from a top earner to a top loss maker. So it's,
That's nerve wracking.
they're up and down. But I think we might see them jump back up again, which, if you're looking to cash in, it might be a good time, but who knows?
Oh, wow. I just see this headline. I have to read it. Trump says China, U.S. could be strategic partners.
Okay.
Did you see that one? There we go.
It's one of those things where it's just, Trump's just having a good time talking to all these bigwigs. I don't know what he actually means.
Yeah.
All right. Anyways.
I mean, it's like BFFs, before they're kind of standing off against each other. Now, anyway.
He just feels good.
Who knows? Maybe who knows? I'm not smart enough.
He spent a day where I went kissing his ass and he feels good. That's
right.
My guess.
Bingo.
Anyways. Oh. All right. Anything else we need to talk about?
I think that's all.
All right.
Thanks, everyone.
Then join us next time on the China Tech Investor Podcast. Bye-bye now.